This is Sounds of Dissent. My name is Amy Grunder. In June 2002, my guest, Nick Terse, was a graduate student researching post-traumatic stress disorder among Vietnam veterans at the U.S. National Archives when an archivist asked him if witnessing war crimes could cause PTSD, and would he like to see some papers. So began a 10-year investigation of U.S. war crimes committed during the war in Vietnam, crimes the Pentagon investigated and substantiated and then covered up. Nick Terse's research led him from the National Archives to the homes of U.S. veterans and of Vietnamese survivors in Vietnam. The declassified documents and the interviews he collected suggest that war crimes like My Lai were not isolated incidents, but were both pervasive and systemic, ultimately causing the deaths of perhaps millions of Vietnamese civilians. Nick Terse's forthcoming book is called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Mr. Terse is an award-winning journalist and historian, managing editor for TomDispatch.com, and a fellow at the Nation Institute. He's also the author of The Complex, How the Military Invades Our Everyday Lives. His investigations of American war crimes in Vietnam have earned him a Reidenhauer Prize for Reportorial Distinction, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a fellowship at Harvard University's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Nick Terse, welcome to Sounds of Dissent.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Your book collects war crime documentation from every kind of source: veterans' memoirs, histories, contemporaneous war reporting, interviews with veterans and survivors, and government documents. Now, allegations of pervasive war crimes committed by American forces in Vietnam were common during and after the war, most often coming from anti-war veterans. But these allegations were denied as exaggerations by the U.S. government. Your book suggests that the U.S. military knew these veterans' accounts were correct. What did you discover in the archive that day, the National Archives, in 2001?
Well, I stumbled upon these records, as you say, and an archivist brought them up to me, and I began looking through them that first day, and I was really shocked by what I saw. These were generally, allegations brought by American veterans or even active duty troops, and they were brought to the attention of U.S. military authorities. Some of these cases, they were files that were the size of phone books. Some were much smaller. Some were paper thin. They looked like they'd been closed without much investigation going on. But I could tell from these records that they were nowhere in the literature at the time, so they'd been kept secret after the war, and I realized that it painted a very different picture than what exists in the 30,000 books that exist on the Vietnam War. I knew that I'd stumble across a treasure trove is the wrong phrase. It was a horror trove. These cases documented massacres, murders, assault, rape, torture. And it was it was American veterans who were talking about these crimes, and I realized that this was a story that needed to be told.
To your knowledge, had anyone seen these files before, other than archivists? Were they classified and had been recently declassified?
They'd been declassified somewhere around maybe 7 years before I found them, but they'd basically sat in the archives untouched, and I asked the archivist, I said, has anyone worked with these before? Because I really couldn't believe they'd just been sitting there. And he said that, people had looked at maybe one or two case files out of there, but generally they just sat on the shelves.
How many case files were there, Nick Terse?
Well, there were several hundred case files that had been thoroughly investigated and found classified as having founded allegations. That is, that the U.S. military criminal investigators acknowledged that there were crimes that could be prosecuted, maybe around 300 of those. Then on top of that, there were another 800 or so allegations that were classified as unfounded. And I realized over the course of my research that unfounded didn't mean that these did not happen. Amidst those files were cases like something that listeners might remember were the Tiger Force killings that the Toledo Blade exposed back in around 2003, a string of atrocities, hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 Vietnamese civilians killed by one particular unit. This case file happened to be in the unfounded files, but as the Toledo Blade eventually showed, these war crimes did happen.
To be clear, your book is about atrocities, and these cases, is about atrocities committed in South Vietnam against South Vietnamese civilians, not against primarily enemy forces in the North or even civilians in the North. Now, journalist Jonathan Schell wrote that the U.S. war in Vietnam was primarily a war against the South Vietnamese people. Break that out for us.
Yes, it's something that some Americans don't quite understand. Even during the war, it was always a great fear of the U.S. anti-war movement that North Vietnam would become the most heavily bombed country in the history of the world. And it turned out that actually it was the American ally, South Vietnam, that ended up with that dubious distinction. The South was where the indigenous revolutionary movement was located, in the great population centers of South Vietnam. There was a revolutionary movement that existed from when Indochina was a French colonial holding, and the South, like the North, fought the French in the 1950s when the U.S. bankrolled the French military effort there, and then when the U.S. took over the war in the 1960s, again the deep revolutionary movement in the South that had long existed there resisted the American invasion and occupation. And as a result, it was the South that was really pummeled by heavy firepower. The Americans were never able to win over the Vietnamese people. So basically what they did was they ratcheted up the firepower in the most heavily populated areas. And as a result, millions of Vietnamese were killed or wounded or made refugees. And these were deliberate U.S. policies.
You write that atrocities that you discovered were committed by every infantry, cavalry, and airborne division, and every brigade deployed without the rest of its division as well. That is, you say, every major army unit in Vietnam. And these, of course, were just the reported cases.
That's right. The original group of records that I found, in no way are they systematic. I mean, we're only talking about many hundreds and hundreds of cases, but over the scope of the war, this is really a fraction of the killing that went on. But these cases, the case files did anecdotally suggest that this was widespread, and as you mentioned, I could see that they occurred in every major Army combat unit that deployed to Vietnam. And then it was widespread over the course of the war, over the basically 10 years of U.S. ground combat in Vietnam, and across the length and breadth of the country. So it gave me a sense of how pervasive it was. And then when I went to Vietnam, that's when I really began to understand what these records were pointing towards.
I'd like to talk about your time in Vietnam, but first, well, perhaps this is relevant. You describe dozens of examples of sort of small-scale My Lais. Now, My Lai, of course, was the notorious butchery of 500 unarmed men, women, and children in March 1968. And it was understood as exceptional at the time. And your evidence shows that perhaps it was not exceptional. Your chapter called A Litany of Atrocities records several dozen of these. You say that most killings by ground troops were smaller than My Lai, but no less horrific. And your examples come from the coastal rice farming provinces of Quang Nam and Quang Gai, but you say that they happened everywhere, and they were caused, you say, by a tactic called search and destroy. Talk about what that tactic was and how it played out, particularly with regard to one company, Company B, 1st Battalion, 35th Infantry, in February 1968.
Well, the search and destroy was a type of operation that was pioneered and named by the staff of General William Westmoreland, who was the top U.S. commander in Vietnam, and he went on to be Army Chief of Staff afterward. And the idea was that you would send U.S. patrols out into the countryside, and basically they were something of a reconnaissance force. Some troops really called it dangling the bait, and that's what it really amounted to. U.S. troops were sent out there to be attacked by enemy forces, and then the U.S. was, the idea was to use heavy firepower to wipe out enemy units. So you would try and keep them in combat and wipe them out with superior firepower. It sounded good on paper to the military, but it was a wholly ineffective tactic because the enemy wasn't stupid enough to try and go toe-to-toe with the most powerful military force in the world. These were peasant guerrilla forces who had vastly inferior weapons. So they used sniping and booby traps and ambushes, and they would not stay in contact. As a result, U.S. troops became frustrated. These are basically American boys, generally 18, 19, 20 years old. They're put in really untenable situations, very tough environment. And they would go into village after village and find only women and children and old men. They then suspected that the men of the village must be enemy guerrillas, and they would take it out on them. And you mentioned this particular unit that I focus a little bit on, Company B, 1st the 35th Infantry. And I found out about this unit, which was sent on these endless search and destroy missions, in the archives files because of a veteran named Jamie Henry, who came to affect my life a great deal. Jamie was, he was basically a hippie living in self-described hippie living in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district before the war, but he was drafted and he became a medic. And a very good one at that. He saved a lot of American lives. But he was really shocked by what he saw in Vietnam on these endless search and destroy patrols. He told me about his first day in the field where he watched as the point man, the lead man in his patrol, molested a young girl. And he thought to himself, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place as his unit patrolled the countryside. He saw a young boy who was executed for no reason, an old man who was used for target practice, a prisoner who was thrown off a cliff, a man who was held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier. I mean, truly horrific events. When he first spoke up about brutality within his unit, his life was threatened. So, his friends in the unit told him, look, you better keep your mouth shut or you're apt to get a bullet in the back during a firefight. So he did. He kept his mouth shut, but Jamie kept his eyes open, and he cataloged all these things that he was witnessing, including the day of February 8th, 1968, when his commanding officer, a captain, a West Point trained captain, issued an order to kill anything that moves when they were inside a village. And Jamie went to try and intervene, but he was too late, and members of his unit gunned down at close range 20 women and children. And Jamie told me that that 30 seconds after that massacre, he vowed to blow the whistle on it. So when he came home, he went to an Army lawyer, and he told his story, and the Army lawyer responded by telling him, look, you better keep your mouth shut, because Jamie was still in the Army at the time, and he said, there's a million ways that the Army can make you disappear. Then Jamie went and met with a criminal investigator who threatened him. He wrote to...
An Army criminal investigator?
An Army criminal investigator, yes. Then he contacted a civilian lawyer who told him he should get some political backing. So he wrote to a couple members of Congress, but none of them responded to him. Then he went public. He spoke out on the radio. He spoke out at anti-war rallies. He wrote an article, held a press conference, but he just couldn't get any kind of traction. And eventually he gave up, and it was only decades later when I showed up, I called him, and then I showed up on his doorstep with a stack of records from the National Archives. That did he realize that the Army had indeed fully investigated his claims and corroborated them. Other members of the unit spoke up finally. They told exactly what they'd seen, everything that Jamie had, and some of them had even seen more. And it was a horrific story that and the Army was, you know, in a position to charge many members of the unit with various crimes, from murder to mutilation, but they didn't take any kind of criminal action against any of them, and the case was basically buried until I found it.
You mentioned that the instructions or the command given to his unit was kill anything that moves, and of course that's the title of your book. Where does there's another very famous rendition of that? That was basically a standing order, wasn't it? The title of your book, "Kill Anything That Moves," was also the command of Captain Medina, who was the commander of the unit that of the operation later to become known as Milai.
That's right. You know, I don't want people to think that I came up with that term for the title, or that it's hyperbole in any way. This is something that I noticed as I started investigating the war. The first time when I saw the phrase in the files of Jamie Henry, it really struck me. And then, you know, that stayed with me. And as I researched the war further, I noticed that this phrase kept popping up. As you mentioned, it was the night before the Milai massacre. Captain Medina was briefing the troops that were to go into Milai the next day, and someone asked, you know, he had given orders that sounded as if the entire village was to be wiped out, and someone asked, well, what about women and children? And Medina's response, according to a number of unit members, was, kill anything that moves. I noticed it there when I read the testimony of another massacre in a different province, Quang Tri province, a year before Milai, a year before the massacre carried out by Jamie Henry's unit, a place called Truai. The order, apparently by the officer before this massacre, was to kill anything that moves. And I noticed it pop up all across the country in Army and Marine units from the mid-1960s into the 1970s. So it really became something of a catch-all, a standing order.
Now, you do also write about command responsibility for these crimes in terms of the drive to ever increase and get high body counts. And I want to get back to that, but there's another aspect of this. Even allowing for the drive to produce bodies here, to count civilians, for example, as enemy dead, that was one way that it played out. Even with that, crimes like this, Milai, for example, shocked the nation when it came to light, not just owing to the number of victims and who the victims were. It was the fact that the villagers weren't just killed, they were butchered. Women and children were sodomized and raped before being killed. One of the soldiers you quote said that rape before killing was standard operating procedure, and these crimes were pervasive according to the veterans themselves. So how do you explain the level of brutality? How did the veterans explain it?
Well, you know, this is something, you know, when I'd sit down with a veteran or call them on the phone, or sometimes, you know, I would cold knock on someone's door without them knowing I was showing up, to try and get, you know, to try and get stories from people before they had a chance to, you know, sometimes come up with a cover story. I was struck by the range of responses. There were some veterans who were entirely unrepentant about what they'd done in Vietnam, and there were others who couldn't believe what they'd carried out. I had one man who had even confessed to carrying out torture, who told me that if he was faced with a Vietnam-type situation again, he would respond in the exact same way. He thought it was appropriate, and this was war. There was another veteran who I talked to for a long time. He was very jovial. He great sense of humor, and he got quiet, and he told me a story about a member of his unit, a very young GI who was going through a village one day, and they were burning it down, and a woman came up to him, and she said she was chattering at the soldier and grabbing at his arm. And of course, she was complaining that her home was being burned down. And he got fed up and hit her in the face with the butt of his M16, of his rifle. And, you know, he walked away laughing as blood poured from her face. And then, you know, this veteran confessed to me that GI he was telling about was him, and that he just couldn't believe he had done it, and he couldn't understand what had driven him to that. I mean, he was frustrated and angry and scared, but he just couldn't connect up the boy he had been, this young man who had been so brutal with himself that day. And I had the same problem. It was hard for me to believe it was the same person I was talking to. But this was the range of responses.
What about what you call the mere gook rule? You talk not just about the battlefield, but also in Saigon, you say that soldiers ran people off the road, deliberately hit them with jeeps, trucks, and tanks, jokingly used them for target practice or for testing a new weapon, killing children who scavenged at camp garbage dumps for food. But you say that this also had to do with racism.
It didn't. This racism was really inculcated from basic training. And again, to emphasize, these are very young men, often teenagers, who were going to basic training. And, 17, sometimes if they were Marine, 18, 19 years old. And the military type of training was really to create a tabula rasa to try and sweep away the previous 18 years of socialization and training and create a military imprint. And at the same time, this training was really infused with racism. And they called it the MGR or Mere Gook Rule, the idea that the Vietnamese were, they weren't human. They were subhuman. They were mere gooks who could be abused or killed at will. And that there really wouldn't be any penalty to carrying out this type of treatment. And, men were just steeped in this idea that you could do anything to the Vietnamese. And they were told that all Vietnamese were potentially enemies. This included women and children. And that it was, safer to target any Vietnamese that you saw. Generally, these troops really couldn't tell, who they were shooting at most of the time. They saw a fleeting glimpse of what they called black pajamas. Most Vietnamese in the countryside wore very loose-fitting black clothing. This was the standard apparel of farmers and also of the guerrillas. So it became very easy to just shoot at anyone in black pajamas. And they learned that the military was pressing for a body count. And they learned that any Vietnamese bodies would do. So they could call in a body count, even if it was a woman or maybe a child, and it would be toted up as a VC kill, Viet Cong or guerrilla kill, and they would be lauded for this. So it became easy to target the Vietnamese in that way, and it became easy in rear echelon areas to abuse the Vietnamese, who generally had no recourse.
You also said that you found a declassified anonymous letter written to General Westmoreland, the commander of the war effort, written after My Lai had made front page news. And this was signed Letter from a Concerned Soldier. This soldier, later identified as George Lewis, wrote to offer eyewitness testimony of mass killings of civilians in the Mekong Delta during an operation known as Speedy Express. We only have about a minute or two left, but I'd like you to say something about Speedy Express.
Sure. The Concerned Sergeant letters that you mentioned detailed a pattern of criminality far larger than any single incident like My Lai or even a long string of atrocities. This anonymous soldier talked about the equivalent of far more than a My Lai a month for over a year. And he served during this operation called Speedy Express, which basically opened up the Mekong Delta, the rice basket of Vietnam and its most densely populated area, to unrestrained attack by artillery, bombing, and also helicopter gunships. And he painted an extremely horrific portrait of just unrestrained killing of civilians. Estimates, the military's own estimates, which I found, came up with about 5,000 to 7,000 civilians killed, so over 10 times the death toll of My Lai.
Did you, you wrote about a couple of journalists' efforts to break this larger story of the systemic murder of civilians being part and parcel of American war policy itself, driven at the very from the very top of the command structure. Talk about Kevin Buckley and Alexander Shimhin of Newsweek, who tried to break this story of Speedy Express. What did they discover? They went and they looked at kill ratios, correct?
They did, and they found that Speedy Express, over the course of the operation, the U.S. claimed 11,000 enemy casualties, but they found less than 800 weapons. They recovered less than 800 weapons, so they knew something was wrong. They didn't know about the concerned sergeant letters or that the military had been looking into this, but they did their own investigation, and they came up with a reasonable estimate of 5,000 civilians killed during this operation. They went throughout the Delta. They interviewed civilians. They interviewed veterans of the 9th Infantry Division, American civilian advisors who were down there, and everyone told them the same story, that there was mass killing there by a unit commanded by a general named Julian Ewell, who became known within the military as the Butcher of the Delta. And they eventually published this in Newsweek, but in a severely truncated form.
Truncated by the editors themselves, right?
Yes.
Who were concerned about embarrassing the Nixon administration.
Yeah, they felt that the Army and the Nixon administration had been through so much because of the My Lai massacre that they didn't think it was fair to subject them to this again. So Newsweek severely edited the article. They cut out a lot of the detail and the incredible reporting that Buckley and Shimkin had done, and it was really a shell of the article it could have been. I mean, this was really the stuff of Pulitzers and congressional investigations, but it made barely a ripple of interest in the U.S.
Okay, here's the absolute last question. I'd like to ask you about the legacy of the war. It seems to me that we can almost talk about the casualty of the war being that the government got better at concealing information and managing information, particularly by journalists. And I'd like you to say something, particularly by managing information brought by journalists. And I'd like you to say something about how this might be playing out now in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where we have signature drone strikes being justified in much the same way as attacks during as policies during the Vietnam War, as not really hurting civilians, etc. And there's very little presence of journalists to report on it. Can you say something about that?
Sure. I mean, the military, the lessons they learned from the Vietnam War, they've always blamed journalists and the peace movement at home and politicians for the loss of the war. And the idea was that there was really too much information out there. And they thought that if information could be controlled and curtailed, that would be a way to further their own efforts. So you saw, after Vietnam, less access to the battlefield, this idea of embedding reporters. It's really removed a lot of independent journalism from the war zone. Because of this, we don't have as clear a picture as we might from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then when you're conducting a remote controlled war in places like Pakistan and Yemen, there aren't journalists on the ground to witness this. So while I don't think the scale of the carnage in the current wars is near that it was in Vietnam, due to a number of reasons, the way artillery and air power are used, I still think that, of course, civilians are being killed on a regular basis, and we don't have good numbers on the civilian toll and don't have a clear picture of what it's really like.
Well, Nick Terse, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
We do, too. Nick Terse is the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, forthcoming from Metropolitan Books and in bookstores this Tuesday, January 15th. Nick Terse is also the managing editor of ForTomDispatch.com and a fellow at the Nation Institute. You can find this interview posted this afternoon at the website archive.org. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.